that neighborhood. Carbon anodes that can glow without damage. So it's a really beefy tube. And you can decide to bias that tube in such a way that it continuously draws current, and we call that class A. And it continuously draws current throughout the cycle of sine wave you put on that control grid. It continuously draws current. The current goes up and down. It goes through the plate tank circuit, and we call it the output signal. By definition, a class A amplifier gives you no more than 50% plate efficiency at full power output. And if for a short period of time you want less than full power output, the efficiency goes down almost in direct proportion, exactly in direct proportion. If you only want 1% of the power output for this period of time, instead of getting 50% efficiency, you get half of 1% efficiency. The plate is still drawing the exact same amount of current continuously. And you decide how much of that gets turned into output signal and how much is just purely wasted by heat by determining how much signal you put on the control grid. Overdrive it, you get a little bit more power output, but now you get distortion in a Class A amplifier. Class B amplifier, you bias it so that it doesn't draw current continuously. A pair of push-pull tubes that draw current only on the positive cycle of each signal on the grid of that particular tube. The right-hand tube conducts on the positive half cycle, and the left-hand tube conducts on the negative half cycle of the input sine wave. That's Class B, and there's various versions of that. Class C is where you use more and more negative voltage on the control grid, so that now the tube draws no current at all until you put a signal in it. And when you put a full amplitude signal into it, the tube only draws current for 70% of the time. The other 30%,
repeater, timeout.
I got that backwards. The tube only draws current for the upper, from 70% and above, I think is the exact number. Yeah, 70 cycles. 70 degrees, there it is. Of the 360 sine wave, 360 degrees of a sine wave, you break up a sine wave into 360 little vertical slices, and each one is 1 degree apart of the original generating waveform. 1 degree of the sine function, trigonometric sine function, that you and I call sine wave. And so only 70 of those degrees is the voltage big enough to overcome the negative voltage on the control grid, and the tube is drawing current. Some drawing current during the peaks of the voltage, the positive peaks, and no other time. And those are very brief pulses of current, but very large magnitude of current. And when you set up the plate circuit correctly for that CW signal, you now generated a much higher efficiency. Numbers like 70 and 80% are possible. The good news about Class C is that it is a lot more efficient of raw DC power input versus real radio power output. That's the good news of Class C. The bad news is it's non-linear as all hell. You amplitude modulate that signal going into a Class C amplifier, and what you get out is pretty ugly sounding. You have to use other fancy techniques to restore linearity. One technique is to modulate the voltage on the plate of the tube as a way of amplitude adjusting the signal. So Class C amplification, high-level plate voltage modulation, is one technique. So each of these biasing techniques, each of these classes of amplifiers, A, B, and C, has its advantages and disadvantages. And there's even a Class D, Class E, and Class F, where the tube is now putting out square waves of current, and you've got fancy filtering circuits to re-establish that into a sine wave, and you can get higher efficiency yet. But the methods of getting linearity are getting more and more elaborate. And when it comes to real high efficiency, used on amateur satellites, like some of the Oscar satellites,
repeater, timeout,
Carl Meinzer, DJ4ZC, invented a technique called envelope restoration linear amplification. He took the input signals that you want to reproduce through that satellite, put them through a hard limiter stage so that the exact phase of a constant amplitude signal was being fed into the the equivalent of the grid of the final tube. He also was measuring the instantaneous amplitude of the composite signal. There's multiple signals going through the satellite. And he made sure that the plate voltage on the equivalent of the final tube of the satellite was being modulated, the plate voltage is modulated, to restore that envelope. The net result is he's got amplification that's linear, but running at something like 70% or so overall efficiency. He had to do that because he needed a certain amount of power in the downlink of each of the signals going through the satellite. 2, 3, 4 hams could talk through the satellite simultaneously. They're all on slightly different frequencies. He was limited on the total amount of solar power he could put on that satellite. His raw power was limited, but by using efficiency techniques called envelope restoration amplification, he was able to get linear power in the downlink with the finite amount of power he could get out of those solar cells. And it was a rather successful satellite. And a number of them were constructed that way. So there are various techniques. We haven't even got into the Dougherty amplifier and other kinds of phase-shifting multi-tube circuits for getting efficiency that have been used on broadcast. So there's a whole lot you can study about the various techniques of using an amplifier, class A, B, C, D, E, and F. And I'm not kidding. Those are the exact labels they're given. So the most classic ones are class A and class B. Class A for pure linear amplification. Class B and variations of it for push-pull amplifiers, audio amplifiers in particular. And class C for high efficiency, other kinds of amplitude modulation, other than the signal going into the control grid. That's a brief thumbnail sketch, but you can add quite a bit to it, thumbnail. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, let's start with this amplifier this gentleman is asking us about. Take a look to a number of different amplifiers. Basically, the amplifiers going from the, oh, I guess, so from the 30s through up to the present, linear amplifiers that you find mostly on the air, fell into the category early. The early category was, as Dick was saying, about a class C amplifier, followed by a very popular amplifier. Let's put it this way. Let me explain about class C amplifier. It was a popular amplifier for AM use. The hands that were not getting into phones or operating CW, ones that ran power, high power, usually had what's known as a class B amplifier. With the coming of single sideband, the amplifiers all fell into the category of what was known as AB1. AB1 was a combination of course, class A amplifier, class B amplifier. And it operated under these conditions that the grid bias and exciting voltage that the plate current flows for approximately one half of the input cycle. So if you wanted to let's say you have this class C amplifier and you'd like to convert it over, you can get rid of course the, you don't need that 500 watt modulator anymore. That's of no value anymore in single sideband because going into this AB1 system, you will be able to use your exciter. And the exciter will be able to drive this amplifier to its kilowatt, and you will modulate it with, of course, the exciter. Let me let it drop. In other words, AB1, Dick, over.
And the AB1, as Mel was indicating, is not quite as continuous as Class A, not quite as discontinuous as Class B, and the 1 indicates that never does it draw a grid current. The instantaneous voltage never makes the grid go to positive with reference to the cathode where grid current is drawn. AB2, I think, did draw a grid current, a more severe service. But AB1 had a kind of linearity because it doesn't draw a grid current, and at least more than half a cycle per push-pull tube current was being drawn. So, therefore, the low-level modulated signal, in other words, the exciter contains all the modulation, amplitude, sideband, FM, whatever. It contains all the modulation. So the signal going into the final amplifier already is formed in the way you would like it to be formed. The only thing you're changing is whether or not you make it stronger. That's a good linear amplifier. AB1, set up correctly, can be quite linear. And for the so-called two-tone test, you can measure the degree of linearity or the degree of distortion, total harmonic distortion. Third order, it's called. We won't get into that tonight. So, at least one of the power supplies that supplies the high voltage to the two RF amplifying tubes, with some modification, the input grid circuit can be reused, the output plate circuit can be reused, the loading circuit, the package, the shielding. An awful lot of the RF section of an old-fashioned AM modulated high power amplifier can be reused today. But as Mel has already indicated, you're probably going to take away all of the audio circuits, the high-power audio output 500-watt transformer. You're not going to use those anymore. You can completely disconnect them from the total system if you want to. And you're not going to be using all of the current output of the power supply. That may allow you to make it more compact. Your power supply in that old network may have used 866 mercury vapor rectifier tubes, which are today a little bit rare, large, can't survive a great deal of vibration, make some noise, have some failure mechanisms, and substituting them with a solid-state diode rectifier system.
Repeater, timeout.
A high-voltage diode rectifier system will give you more efficiency, less heat, smaller size, less weight, less vulnerability to vibration, so you might want to update the power supply. One of the things to worry about is old-fashioned power supplies. If they were made out of oil-filled capacitors, no problem. Many of the power supplies in the intermediate years, like the ones that are on a Heathkit SD, I guess, what is that, a Heathkit SD 1000, 2000? The Heathkit amplifiers used aluminum electrolytic capacitors in various series and parallel combinations to inexpensively make the filter capacitor for the power supply. In most cases, those capacitors do not survive more than 10 or 15 or so years. Here you are 25 years downrange, and you get one of those amplifiers. I don't care if it's been put on the shelf in a hermetic sealed package and treated with tender loving care all of these years. You plug that in today and simply turn it on, and some of those capacitors are completely dried out, and they've got no microfarads at all. Some of them have become a short circuit. Your chances of being able to reuse those particular capacitors is very slim. You're going to have to replace them with more modern things. So some of the older circuits, some of those portions, might not have survived. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, let me tell you, most of those old amplifiers, I have had a number of them, taken apart a number of them, they all had mostly all oil-filled, you know, filter capacitors in them, like you say, using the 866 rectifiers and all. They were pretty tough power supply. Transformers were among them most of the time, way overrated for everything had to be more or less like, if you talk about like Collins, everything had to be keyed down indefinite because those AM transmitters actually were built upon the premise that they're going to be used for broadcasting, maybe on different frequencies that we, you know, think of broadcast transmitters, but there are plenty of effects. I hear them on 80 meters, 75 meters, they're there's a number of guys that are using the old Collins broadcast transmitters. They claim, of course, they're running them at lower power. They are originally 5kW rigs, you know, big monsters in 4 foot wide by 4 foot deep by 8 foot tall cabinets that weigh about 2 tons. But there's a number of them that are on the air. But, okay, under these conditions, as Dick just said, that Class AB1, which is your linear amplifiers that you'll see on the market, such as the Eastkit, such as a number of the Alphas or the any of them that are the Meritrons and all that, of using a pair of tubes run AB1. And the idea is that what we call the plate current is actually what we call appreciably greater than 180 degrees operating angle of it. Is greater than 180 degrees, but less than 360 degrees. That's basically what we're talking about in AB1. And, of course, the grid current does not flow on any portion of the input cycle. Whereas a Class D amplifier, the angle of the plate current flow of a Class D amplifier is less than 180 degrees. In other words, the plate current flows in appreciably, usually with less than one half the time. And actually, the actual operating of a Class D amp repeater.
Time out.
There was a bit of a timeout that time. By the way, I found the book that I was talking about earlier. This book that I'm recommending for people who want to know about op-amps is called by Analog Devices, Op-Amp Applications. That's the name of the book, Op-Amp Applications. The version I bought, I think, was published around 2000, and I see they have updated it, and now there's an Op-Amp Applications handbook edited in 2006. And if you go to analog, I expect it to be analogdevices.com. It's analog.com/brand, B-R-A-N, / analog dialogue. Just by Googling analog devices and op-amp handbook, you'll find it. Now, these huge, long URLs are kind of hard to relate, because every so often, portions of it are case-sensitive, and you'll just get no such address that just exists as an answer. But that book was $40 in its version that I bought around what I think was the 2000 version, which I bought in 2006. And it's been updated to the 2006 version. And the one I bought has a white front cover with a schematic diagram of an op-amp and a feedback network. The 2006 version has got a more colorful front cover. I'm trying to figure out what is that a picture of on the front cover. I clicked on the picture and it gave me a picture of the world. I don't believe that. And let's see. I'll eventually find out what the price of the new one is, but it's worth it. It contains almost all the information in the earlier Carl Jung books, as well as a number of other experts in the area. So, we got to worry about timing out a little bit, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Let's say extra zeros on that, on the ID for Dick.
Yeah, the 00 is a darn good question. That might represent the setting of the clock. I know the repeater no longer has / RP, you know, telling you it's a repeater. It's W2VL00. And I think it means the clock is not set, but I'm not sure. Back to you, Mel.
When I timed it out, yeah, I should have. I noticed I didn't keep an eye on the time. Did I clip off anything of importance?
You had gone through quite a bit of the explanation of AB1 and C. Oh, by the way, if you go to the right website, it lists what the name and subject matter is of each individual section. And it's possible. possible that this can be downloaded? Wow. You mean to tell me they're giving this thing away for free and I paid $40 for it? Even so, I'd still like to buy it. When it comes to a book that's got, let me pick a number, 600 pages, if you download 600 pages, yes, sure enough, they download the whole darn book. Wow. You don't have to pay for it. I would, because I like to have a nice bound book with all the color illustrations and whatever, as opposed to a whole bunch of papers that come out of my Xerox printer, my, what do they call it now, laser printer, and you've got to bind them in some way. It's nowhere near as convenient as buying the real book. For something that you're going to use for that many years, I think it's better to buy the whole thing rather than download it. There's a bunch of pages that wears out your printer cartridge, if you know what I mean. I think a printer cartridge may not be good for much more than 1,000 pages, and I hate to waste a whole printer. If you look at the price of the printer cartridge versus the price of the book, it's quite possible you come out ahead buying the book, even though they'll give it to you so-called free of charge. K-U-K-E-Y, K-U-R-I-W.
Life, that my reference books and all, I love to be able just to go over the shelf and grab what I want when I want, when I need it. Okay, but the final words on amplifiers, it is very doable, and I think you'll find it very simple. In fact, you'll find it in, I'm sure the ARRL has covered this many times in converting the old class D amplifiers for linear use in single sideband, and basically as Dick said, it's most likely just a matter of changing things like the bias around the grid bias, possibly the cathode bias. Some of them would have to be changed, but everything in as far as the power supply can stay the same. The output circuit, the tuning, the loading controls, the coil, the system stays the same. No touching. The tube will light up the same way and everything. So the tuned input networks and everything, leave it as is. That's, I guess I'm going to find you're going to have maybe a handful of little components here and there that you'll change around. Maybe not even that. Just a couple of components, maybe no more than maybe two components change. So really good use one of those amplifiers, because many of them were brutes of the amplifiers, and they'll work for you forever if you don't mind, you know, the size and weight. Okay, so we let that go, Dick?
Yeah, we may have covered that one enough for the time being, Mel. And there may be enough time for another letter. The choice is yours.
Okay, trying to find something, you know, that you know, hold it. I'm sorry. What is, okay, here's one basically simple question. What is actually meant by impedance matching of a transformer?
I think you passed that over to me. Okay. If I was building an experimental circuit where I made my own transformer the hard way, and if it's an audio transformer, for instance, or a power transformer running on 60 cycle power here in 50 hertz in Europe, there's a certain number of minimum turns to the primary winding required for the transmitter to work well. There's got to be enough turns so that the transformer doesn't saturate, and not too many turns to where you build up a whole lot of resistance in all the wire of all those turns. So there's a compromise there. But once you set the number of turns of primary, if you made the number of turns of the secondary identical, you and I would call this a one-to-one isolation transformer. Put 110 volts into the primary, you'll get very close to 110 volts of AC out of the secondary. At first, it looks like that's a useless thing to do, but it gives you certain kinds of protection from electrical shock because the secondary winding is thoroughly isolated from the primary winding. The thing you've got to worry about with Con Ed and LIPA wiring, for instance, is that, yes, there's 110 volts, 120 volts between those standing in some wet water, and therefore you're connected to wet earth. You just touch one wire, and you can receive an electrical shock, so it's dangerous. Once you put in an isolation transformer, and now you've got two floating wires on that secondary winding, neither of which is grounded. Now, in theory, if you only touch one of those wires, you're safe. I didn't say you should do it. I'm just saying you would be safe in the ideal world. Don't do it because someone may have told you that's an isolation transformer, and maybe it's not. Let me drop. Now, with that one-to-one winding, if I'm using that transformer within the frequency range where it is designed, and if I put a 50-ohm resistor across the secondary winding, and I look into the primary winding with laboratory instrumentation, and I measure what does the primary winding look like, for the most part, the primary winding would look like a 50-ohm resistor, because the transformer is one-to-one. If I now add some turns to that secondary winding, and I double the number of turns, one of the things you've got to memorize is that the impedance ratio of a transformer is a function of the turns ratio squared. I've doubled the number of turns of the secondary compared to the primary. 2 to 1 is the ratio of turns. I square that, I get the number 4. 4 to 1 is the ratio of impedance. If I now leave that 50-ohm resistor across the secondary winding, which has got twice the number of turns, and I look into the primary winding with laboratory instrumentation, I used to see 50 ohms, but I changed the number of turns. Things have now changed by a 4-to-1 ratio. 1/4 of 50 ohms is 12.5. I look into the primary winding. I got it backwards. Sorry about that. What do you think? Nope, got it right. The primary winding, when I look into it with laboratory instrumentation, it will look like a 12.5-ohm resistor as far as the AC loading is concerned. I'm doing this measurement at 1 kilohertz, and I've designed a transformer that likes 1 kilohertz. So, turns ratio allows impedances to change. If I happen to have an amplifier that wants to see 12.5 ohms to work correctly, and produce the right amount of high fidelity, and if my loudspeaker just happens to be 50 ohms, and I connect my loudspeaker instead of that resistor I had on the secondary winding, that transformer would now
repeater timeout.
That transformer would, in theory, be the perfect impedance matching device. The amplifier sees what it wants to see, 12.5. The loudspeaker, in my silly example, a 50-ohm loudspeaker, it sees 50 ohms, it's happy. Ordinarily, my 50-ohm loudspeaker, going to an amplifier designed for 12.5 ohms, wouldn't work so well, wouldn't produce the right amount of power, and whatever. So, that's a simple example, I think, of using a transformer to go from one impedance to another. There's a lot more things you can do with it, but it is a... It's a little bit like a gear shift. In the case of gear number 1 of your automobile, the engine turns very fast and the wheel turns very slow. And so when you're first beginning to start up from a standstill operation of your automobile, first gear is very handy. But when you really get rolling down the road, first gear at a 60-mile-an-hour rate would force your engine to turn over at 12,000 RPM, and it can't do that safely. So you change the gears. That gearbox is an impedance-matching device in your automobile. When you're in the right gear for the speed you're going, the engine is turning at the right rate, it's producing the right horsepower, it sees the wheels, so to speak, with the right impedance. Depending on how fast you're moving, there's a different impedance that's ideal, first gear versus third gear. A transformer that I just gave you an example of is sort of a first gear and third gear like operating device. K2KUI, K2LIW.
This is K2KUI. Yep, sounds like a very good explanation. But let me see if I can sort of, I don't know, just say in a few simpler words, because I always get that. Now, please put it into simple words. The ideal transformer ideal transformer. What is an ideal transformer? That means that the peak of the secondary load, in other words, whatever we put on the secondary, is reflected back to the primary in a specific relationship. So that what happens is that a specific load connected to the secondary terminals of the transformer will be transformed to a specific value appearing across the primary terminal. So what is Dick saying? That by the proper ratio of turns, any reasonable value of secondary load may be reflected to the primary of the transformer and will then give a desired transformer primary impedance. In other words, you've got to get a balance, as Dick was saying, he was explaining, like with the gear shifts and all. Get a balance. This is what we're doing. And there's I don't know if I should get into it, but there's another factor comes in called phase angle. But I'm going to leave it at this for the time being. Make a little bit of a critique on this, because the second part of it is, you know, about things like using auto transformers and all, which is what effect. I guess this is for somebody that's going studying, you know, basics, the beginnings of electronic takeover.
Yeah, real transformers do have a small non-ideal characteristic called phase shift. The signal coming out of the secondary is a little bit phase shifted compared to primary. Most of the time, 98% of the time, it's a minor factor. You can ignore it. And one of the things that Mel and I haven't mentioned yet is putting a signal into a number of turns of wire that we call the primary winding, and it's wound on this iron core of this audio transformer or power transformer, call it what you like. On top of that primary winding, we put an entirely different secondary winding, another bunch of turns of wire, thoroughly insulated from the primary winding by way of the varnish insulation on the wire or a cloth or fish paper or something else we put in between. The secondary winding is wound on top of the primary winding. They're thoroughly insulated from each other. You could put an ohmmeter between the wires of the primary winding and the wires of the secondary winding, and your ohmmeter will measure infinity. They're not connected in any way. There's a catch. They are connected by the magnetic field. That's the magic of the transformer. That primary winding, when you put voltage or current through it, creates a magnetic field. The reason the iron is there is the magnetic field will flow through the iron 50 times better than it will through air. So you wind the wire on that piece of iron. The magnetic field flows through the piece of iron because of the voltage or current you put into the primary winding. The secondary winding is in the middle of that exact same magnetic field. That's the mechanism by which the energy goes from primary to secondary. So the primary sets up a magnetic field. The secondary is there. By something called Lenz's law, the rate at which you change the magnetic field in that winding determines how many volts per turn you get out of it. And the nice thing about the way things balance in a nearly ideal transformer is you count the turns in the primary, you count the turns in the secondary, it tells you the ratio by which that magnetic field couples, so you know how many...
Repeater, timeout.
So you know how many volts you get out of the secondary. Your forward spark coil, or the ignition coil in your automobile, is a kind of a transformer. You put 12 volts into the primary, which has got a very small number of turns, sets up a pretty big magnetic field. The points open up in the old-fashioned ignition system. The current in the primary is instantaneously interrupted. The magnetic field rapidly begins to collapse. The secondary winding has got a whole lot of turns, and it has a rapidly changing magnetic field that's collapsing. Therefore, 20,000 volts is generated across that secondary winding. It goes through your distributor, through the wire, high voltage wiring, to the spark plug. The spark plug spark plug makes a spark, the fuel mixture in the cylinder fires, and the automobile goes. That spark coil in your car is a kind of transformer. You happen not to be giving it a sine wave. You connect and disconnect your 12-volt battery to it by way of the system of points or the transistor equivalent. But the main thing that transformers do is create a magnetic field through the iron core. It couples between primary and secondary. And like a gear shift, you can decide whether it's in first gear, second gear, third gear, or overdrive by determining whether or not you make more turns to the secondary compared to the primary, or vice versa. You set up the turns, it sets up the voltage ratio, and voltage ratio squared, which happens to be turns ratio squared, is impedance ratio. Why does you take the number of turns as a ratio and square it to make impedance ratio? That's a little complicated. We won't go there tonight. For the time being, just memorize it. KQKEY, KQRAW.
This is KQKEY. Let me put a little simpler here. I think that if you measured with an ohmmeter between primary and secondary, the absolutely nothing that the transformers could, of course, because it does have this insulation, as Vic would say, that's wound in there, and it has the iron core that is where the many transformers you open up. You see these little, they call them laminations, pieces of strip of metal. And the reason they did that is to break up a condition, well, we won't get into, called hysteresis, but one other thing that you must understand. What comes along with a good operating transformer is one thing that we got to understand comes in, and that is what we call capacitive secondary load. Because the transformer, even though the two windings are separated, it forms a type of capacitance. And this is a factor that comes into effect. How do I explain this? It is like a resistive reflection back to the primary source. So the primary source sees the transformer load really dependent upon the secondary load and the turns ratio of the transformer. This is basically what you're looking at. Again, I'll say it's the primary source sees the transformer load entirely dependent upon the secondary load. That's the secondary load speed and the turns ratio of the transformer. This is what constitutes a transformer. And there's a couple of formulas if you want to know how to understand how to figure out if you wanted to wind your own, basically. But I guess we'll let that go for now. I think, I don't know, do we sound pretty good on this Pete's transformation, over?
Yeah, I think we've given an introduction to the subject. If you Google the word transformer, transformer design, turns ratio, Google transformer plus turns ratio, and then plus Wikipedia, guaranteed there's a Wikipedia explanation of a transformer, where somebody's got some nice explanations, nice diagrams, some good words, and that'll help. Among electronic engineers, transformers are reasonably troublesome. Of the engineers that come out of a good 4-year school in electrical engineering with a bachelor's degree in their hand, it is my guess that less than 30% of them have a good working knowledge of transformers and would be able to go out and design one. When I needed, way back in the dark ages of 1959, I think it was, I needed a transformer to make a 12-volt power supply running from a 120-volt AC circuit. And in those days, there was no Radio Shack. You had Edley Electronics. You had Lafayette Electronics. But on the shelf of Lafayette Electronics, there was no 12 or 15-volt transformer ready for a transistor circuit. Everybody was using tubes in those days, power supplies didn't exist. I had to wind my own transformer. I saved a whole lot of effort by not winding the primary. I just took something called an audio output transformer from a tube-type radio, and I used its primary winding, the one that went to the plate of the tube. I connected that directly to the 110-volt line. Wound a couple of turns onto that of my own wire, measured the voltage, figured out how many turns must be in the primary. I didn't bother taking it apart to count the 2,000 turns that might have been in that secondary. I just made an electrical measurement, wound the right amount of number of turns on, and made my own transformer. And I, in those days, in those dark ages, for me to find an article telling me how to do that didn't exist, in my opinion. There was no internet. The library books I had access to didn't have it. A minor amount of coverage of that form existed in the radio amateur handbook, but not enough.
Repeater, timeout.
I had to do a bunch of experiments to find out how to wind my own transformer. That piece of electronics is still operational today, sitting on a shelf in my basement. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1257 of the series that began in September of 1982. Assuming Mel and I stay healthy, we'll be back next week and carry on a little more of this. There's a little more to the story. Of antennas, transmission lines, transformers, operational amplifiers, transistors, transmitters, receivers, propagation, satellites, computers, high-speed data, digital television. There's a little more to the story. And we'll attack a little bit of it next week. Mel, to take it, be kind to each other. See you guys down the line. K2KEY, K2RIW.